Welcome to Convergence. I'm Ellen Taylor alongside my co-host Michelle MacLoon, and she's in lockdown in Germany. But today joining the show, we're going to talk a little bit about what is the price of this COVID-19 panic. And we bring in an expert today who's written a book called The Price of Panic. It's written by Douglas Axe, William M. Briggs, and J.W. Richards. It's available in Regnery Press. And so joining us today is J. Richards from Washington, D.C., where he also wears the numerous hats at Catholic University of America. Welcome, Jay.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Great.
Jay, this book, The Price of Panic, and I have to caveat it with my audience right now, or our audience, is... Okay, I live in Germany. I live in, and right now I'm currently in Bavaria, where the lockdown restrictions are bordering on draconian. People are pulling cars over. If there's three people, if there's three adults in the car, they're pulling people over. They've now mandated what kind of mask you have to wear. And the really sad thing about this is the numbers have not changed. Mm-hmm. This restrictive policy has been in place since November 10th and continues to today. But your book, The Price of Panic, really situates this pandemic in terms of what are we really dealing with? Mm-hmm. Is it a social media phenomena? Is it a health phenomena? Is it a economic phenomena? Is it a conspiracy? What are we dealing with?
The simple answer is yes, I think.
Yes.
The reality is in the book, we think that, of course there is a viral contagion, but we think that's not the main story. The main story is this social contagion in which essentially the role of what we call the tyranny of experts, which is the problem isn't experts per se, it's a few highly specialized public health experts given too much influence and authority over global public policy, then elevated by the media to become these sort of infallible oracles of scientific truth that can't be challenged. And then that all amplified by a tendency on the part of the media to panic the public, because we have this thing called novelty bias. We're more interested in unusual things than, nobody wants to hear a story about how most people are still alive today, right? But we want to know if a plane crashes. And so this is why there's this kind of fixation on cases or hospitalizations, this novelty bias. And then social media, which makes this direct and immediate to us. I mean, in some ways, there have been social contagions and panics. You know, there's a famous Dutch tulip panic, for instance, that had to do with the trading of tulips. But this is the first time in which you had the social conditions and the technological ability to have a global social contagion. And so in the book, that's really what we talk about. We talk about the kind of series of events that allowed this to happen. And then we evaluate the policies that were supposed to make this better. So we spend a little bit of time on masks, but we mainly spend time on lockdowns because we think the lockdowns are the things that really have major unintended consequences in terms of well-being and jobs and what have you. And we really think that we show by looking at the data that the government-imposed lockdowns simply don't make any difference in terms of the trajectory of this virus. It's a respiratory virus. And so even though it started in a weird part of the year last year, and so we had a strange season, this season and from now on, this is just going to become a part of the flu season. It will be a flu COVID cold season. And that's something that, that's a reality in which, they'll spike in January and then they decline because we're normally trapped inside in the winter in the Northern Hemisphere, then we go outside in the summer and it goes away or declines. But the lockdowns, if anything, are probably making this worse. And that's the tragedy of the story, is that it's not just that we had to do something that had bad costs on the other side. You could say, well, maybe there's pain on one side, but there's gain on the other. In fact, if you look at the data, compare individual states, compare countries with each other, it's clear the lockdowns are all pain and no gain.
So, Jay, it doesn't appear that lockdowns are serving the purpose of containing the virus. Yet they continue, and as Michelle can attest to, they continue in very draconian ways. And we don't seem to be moving forward to resolve that. Like, well, let's lift the lockdowns. Let's evaluate what happened and make a new policy going forward. They just seem kind of stuck in either Is it a power struggle on who controls the lockdowns and what happens? Why can we not move forward out of lockdowns with the realization they're not doing what we hoped they would?
Well, of course, some states did do that. Georgia figured this out. Florida figured this out. Governor DeSantis in Florida was great. He, you know, initially said, okay, we don't quite know what we're dealing with, but he talked to scientists in Europe. He figured out, okay, this is very dangerous for the elderly that are in nursing homes, not so much for other people, especially those that are healthy. And so we'll focus on that and we'll open the state back up. We're all told everybody's going to die in Florida. And then turns out, no, it's following just kind of the trajectory you'd expect. I think mainly what we're dealing with is incentives. So I don't think politicians are sitting around for the most part and thinking, okay, how can we make life miserable? Because generally, you know, if they make life miserable, there's going to be negative consequences at some point. I think what we're dealing with is incentives. So imagine you're a governor who said, we have to close businesses, we have to close churches, we have to close the schools in order to save millions of people, right? At what point do you say, sorry, those don't work. That was a mistake. I made a huge mistake. Let's do something different. Politicians don't do that because, you know, they just don't, for the most part. And so to say, okay, let's open things up would be an admission that lockdowns the first time were probably a really, really stupid idea. And so what we're dealing with here is it's like a conveyor belt in which most politicians are not willing to get off once they've actually gotten on. And this is kind of double bind that President Biden is in now, is because, you know, politically, I think it would probably be clever for him to say, let's open up the country. But he spent months saying that we need to lock down and add more masks. And so to suddenly say, oh, those were a bad idea, he would basically have to admit his entire campaign was based on false assumptions.
But California's doing that right now. I mean, that's what they're trying this week, it seems like. Oh, we're just going to open up even though cases aren't down.
Well, that is, there's a couple of weird indicators. So Newsom, Mayor Cuomo or Governor Cuomo in New York, and then Governor Whitmer in Michigan have all said, okay, well, you can't really keep doing this, partly because those are the states that have said such draconian lockdowns that it's really a disaster. And so there is reality pushing against this. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's only so much you can do before you, first of all, you devastate your state or your country, and you create a rebellion. And so what I've thought from the very beginning that as long as a majority of the population complies with whatever the diktat is, it will continue. If an entire city just simply refuses to comply, the mayor's not going to be able to enforce that. But the reality is that large percentages of us are still terrified. And so it's not that the police are necessarily having to enforce this. We're enforcing it on ourselves. We're snitching on our neighbors. And so I think that's the kind of key thing. This isn't just government imposing its will on us. It's us complying and buying into it. And that's what's been so terrifying.
Still terrified. Jay, what I'm absolutely fascinated, and your book brings this up because the numbers have never made sense. What started this viral panic?
Really, if you had to pin down one thing, it would always a couple things. One, it was mysterious in its origin. So it's from China. It was suspicious about where it came from. The wet market story sounded fishy. We actually think it probably leaked accidentally from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So that gave it a kind of weird mystery. And then you had this computer model out of the Imperial College London that assumed that the virus had an infection fatality rate of 3.4%. So in other words, about 3.5% of the people that got it were going to die, according to this model. That's where we got that number of 2.2 million Americans dead in the first season, unless we did the lockdowns. It came from that model, but the model was just based on the assumptions of the modelers. And we knew within a month that it was just it was bogus. It just was not at all reliable because it hadn't been tested against the evidence. Unfortunately, by that point, the director general of the World Health Organization, the head of the CDC, the President Trump's coronavirus task force, they had all bought the model. And in fact, when President Trump spoke last April, he said, well, two very smart people came into my office and they said 2.2 million people are going to die unless we shut it down. And so I felt like, well, we're going to have to do it. Well, that number, the only basis for that number is a computer model we now know was false. And yet people still are appealing to that number when they say, well, yeah, this is terrible, but think how many more people would have died if we had not done this. Again, the infection fatality rate we know is wrong. It's orders of magnitude too high. The second thing is that the lockdowns themselves, the effect of the lockdowns was another assumption of the model. The model assumed that if we do the lockdowns, they're going to have this particular effect. But if you look at the history of pandemics, we've never tried population-wide lockdowns before. So even that idea had not been tested. We're basically running an experiment to test a hypothesis on the human population. That's the bad news. The good news is we already have plenty of evidence to show that they're a terrible idea. But the secondary bad news is that we still haven't learned that lesson.
So it seems to me, and call me a little cynical, that some governments have taken advantage of the power that has been put in their hands through this process and really utilized it or tried to maneuver it so things going forward give them even more power. And I guess the hardest part is, as a citizen, is to watch and say, well, why are we not upset as citizenry? And why are we acquiescing our power to these unknown governments? And is there a way to stop that too?
The only way really to stop that is to wake up. I mean, because in general, politicians respond to incentives and they respond to the views of the electorate. Not perfectly, but if 80% of a state is utterly hostile to the idea of lockdowns and actually acts in that way, there's no governor in the United States that's going to have the ability to withstand that. And so governors are sort of counting on social compliance. What's weird is that you have these much greater protests. I see some of these protests in Berlin or in Amsterdam. I'm hearing rumors. I have a French friend who tells me that it's about to start actually in France as well. We don't see those kinds of anti-lockdown protests here like we have seen elsewhere. And that it's a mysterious thing. I just think, honestly, the only thing I can attribute it to is the capacity of media and social media to keep us in a constant state of panic.
Well, also here, the lockdowns are so much more draconian. You cannot even compare them to the United States. When police can pull you over in the car and ask why there's three people in the car, I'd like for the Georgia police, the Michigan police to do that and it not go to the Supreme Court. I mean, you know, it's really a study in civil liberties. And it's a study in how we look at ourselves through the eyes of government. In the United States, we have the tradition that we have formed a democracy to prevent tyranny. Here in the continental Europe, there all rights come from the government and not from God. And so that is why they could get away with this just absolutely crazy lockdown, even in the face of evidence that it is doing nothing right now. You wonder where it ends at this point.
Yeah, that does suggest that there's far more draconian instances. I've been on radio and TV actually in Victoria, the province of Australia, several times. And it really is. It's just like a police state there for many people. And so I think that's an important point, because it may be that, even though we're having a lot of intolerable lockdowns in a lot of states of the U.S., it's not as bad as it is in some places in the U.K. and the continental European countries.
One of the things I think contributing to us, to our complacency in accepting this, is we have become very content to sit in our comfortable homes and order from anything online. And I call it the laptop culture. You know, their entire existence is fine online. Well, you know, and I'll wave to my neighbor and my brother-in-law will swing by and that's it. We're good. So we have become, part of us have become, that are able to, very comfortable in sitting in our lockdown and typing away on our computers.
Yeah, well, I think that can be both a good and a bad thing, right? I mean, I'm glad that we're able to do this podcast, for instance, and we're looking at each other, right?
Even though we're
in Alabama, D.C., and Germany. Uh-huh. I've done, frankly, 95% of my job, it turns out, can be done digitally. Mm-hmm. And so guess what? I saved so much time on my commute and all my canceled trips that I wrote a book with two other guys at lockdown, right?
You wrote two books.
Yeah, we're in the digital economy. The other book I wrote a book on fasting, but that was done before the lockdowns. But I mean, in some ways, there's a great divide. If your job can be digitized, or if it can be done over Zoom or over the computer, or over the internet, this has probably not been that bad for you. But if it can't be, if you live in the analog world and your job requires that, you know, you can't digitize housekeeping. You can't digitize construction and landscaping. And a few have done well because they've been able to plug into Grubhub and to deliver, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of weird dynamic that's happened in which the digitization of the economy has been accelerated. And so that's led, unfortunately, to some winners and losers. The sad thing is that many of the people that are the losers are the ones that could least afford a decline, obviously. I mean, it's one thing if you're well off and you have a 5% decline in your income. It's another thing if you're right on the edge.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, are you seeing that in Germany and Europe too?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what the Germans are saying and the Europeans in general. I won't have a restaurant in a couple months. Now, the German government is making whole salaries, at least up to 3/4. Germany is the richest country in the European Union. Mm-hmm. But how long can you do that for? You cannot. And they're saying, we're done. If we open back up, they're not going to make whole our salaries, but we're done. So it's very, very concerning. And you know what's very interesting? As the lockdowns go further, you don't hear about ventilator capacity anymore. No. You don't even really hear about hospital capacity. No. You don't see overcrowded hospitals. You hear about, well, the hospitals are at 80%. Mm-hmm. Well, 80%, that sounds like it's a functioning hospital.
That's what it is. Right? I mean, the reality is, does anybody remember ever tracking hospital capacity until this year? No, we don't. No one ever knew. But the reality is that every flu season, hospitals get tapped out. Hospitals don't prepare and build out their inventory for the zombie apocalypse because the zombie apocalypses don't happen. That would be really dumb. What they do is that they sort of they prepare for dealing with surges and things like a major flu surge, and that's what they're dealing with. So of course, it's January. They're going to have to be dealing with this. But I myself had COVID in November, and I actually went to the hospital temporarily because my oxygen went down and my wife frankly made me go. I didn't want to go, you know? Right. And so I saw, they're dealing with it. And so, of course, also we're hearing a lot about cases, but as we've learned here now in the last couple of weeks, the cases are being misdefined. And so a case is supposed to be someone who's so sick and symptomatic that he or she has to get medical treatment, and then you get tested for a bug, a disease, and it's confirmed. Well, what we've been doing is testing in the United States about 2 million people every single day. We're testing them with these particular types of tests, in many cases, the PCR tests, that are prone to false positives. And then if someone just gets a positive test, that's counted as a case, even if they're asymptomatic. That's the wrong way to do it. I mean, what we want to know is, okay, how many people are sick? How many people are going to the hospital? And how many people are dying? But because we're testing so many people and positive tests are counting for cases, we're almost certainly overcounting. And so we're counting lots of things that would otherwise, people that are sick or end up dying, we're counting them as COVID deaths when in fact they're not. And we'll know that, just like we'll know it in 2020, we'll know it in 2021 by essentially calculating the excess deaths and noticing, okay, it's weird because a bunch of diseases seem to have disappeared off the map. Well, what that is, that's evidence that essentially the official COVID death coding is poaching water that would be otherwise been other deaths. And so we've got to learn as a population to make some basic distinctions, or I don't see that there's ever any end to this.
Jay, you've just mentioned a term that I would love to have you explain because I read about it in your book. Also, it has been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal for the last couple of weeks. That term, excess death. What does that mean?
So excess death, basically what we do is, of course, in the United States, we have a slight increase in population everywhere year. So you sort of calculate for that. And then what you do is, you know, every year we say, okay, how many people die? We don't actually, though, you might think that we determine the number of people that die from the flu, for instance, just by every person that's sort of recorded as having the flu. That's not actually how it's done. What you do, if you look at the death curves over the course of a year in the United States and everywhere else, you see a spike in the winter every year, and that's the result of flu and really from pneumonia. That's a complication from the flu. And so the way we figure out those deaths is by basically counting up all the people that died of cancer, all the people that die of heart disease, all of those are recorded. And then that excess that you see is attributed to basically the flu and to pneumonia, which is essentially, that's what ends up killing all of us if we survive the other things. We all have a finite life expectancy. And so once you get really old and infirm, inevitably, if you're not going to die of a heart attack or cancer, it ends up being a cold or the flu that becomes pneumonia, and that's what kills you. And so that's what that spike is. And so the question all along has been, okay, how many excess people above and beyond that were killed by COVID-19 in 2020? Or would a lot of the people that died of COVID-19 otherwise have died of those other types of deaths that sort of are built on top of the ones that we code? And so if you get, let's say, in 2020, you know, 20% more people die in 2020 than in 2019, that tells you there's something new. Right, over and above everything else that happens. But if it's not that, then you got to figure out something else by looking at the data in 2020. We absolutely had excess deaths above and beyond what would have expected. Some of those, I think, are almost certainly COVID-19 deaths. So these are deaths that would have would not have happened otherwise. But some of these deaths are lockdown deaths. In fact, I think it may even equal that. So the deaths of despair, increase in suicides, drug and alcohol overdoses, deaths from missed cancer screenings, missed from heart disease screenings, things like that. So there's excess deaths. Some are COVID, some are lockdowns, lockdown related.
That'll be interesting when we start to dive into those numbers going down the road. And, yes. And what that really, and can we really extrapolate out the proper numbers? That'll be interesting because there is always the question of the coding.
Yeah, there is. Yes. And the nice thing about looking at total numbers is that, you know, the total number just is what it is. And so you can be agnostic about the coding and just say, okay, how many people died, right? And when did they die? And so you get the curve and then you can work that out. But if you then, you know, work out the details and it looks like, well, gosh, there's absolutely no one that seemed to die of the flu or die of some other things, that's going to suggest, okay, those diseases didn't disappear. They have been coded as COVID, and that will help us. And so that's why in the book we said, look, we can't talk about excess deaths in 2020 because the year's not over yet. Right. We had to extrapolate. And so far, there's nothing in the book that we'll have to correct at the moment, but we'll see.
I also wonder what would happen if it didn't happen in a election year in the United States when we were picking a new president, too.
Well, that was what was very frustrating because, and we detail this in the book, is that the media just essentially took whatever the opposite position of President Trump is. And so I'm convinced the fate of hydroxychloroquine, for instance, the media was utterly incapable of objectively dealing with this widely known and used drug that's been being used for decades, simply because President Trump said a nice thing about it. And the idea that, well, oh, the president said something's good, we have to say it's bad. And it was quite obvious that's exactly what the media was doing. Part of me hoped that, okay, maybe the panic porn will stop after the election. And there are little signs that maybe there's going to be some of that, but at least at the moment, it certainly hasn't stopped.
I think at some point, it's got to start mitigating your voter base. Yeah. If this, you know, how many restaurant owners are going to vote for someone who was voted democratically, but has not, the state legislature did not close down the state, the dictate of a governor that closed the state down.
Here's what's weird is that in most of these states, I can tell you the governors that have gone more than 30 days are way, way, way outside their legal limits. And so state governors have emergency powers, but they're temporary in case there's a tsunami or something like that.
You know, there's doctoral candidates yet to be born that are going to be writing about this.
They will be talking about the politics and the sociology of this. It's fairly uneventful. It's something like the flu strain of the Hong Kong flu in 1968. It's comparable to that. Now, a poll in July of Americans on average thought in July that it killed 9% of the U.S. population, 9%. Okay, well, the actual number was 0.06%. So they're off by 150 times. So the average American thinks it's 150 times more deadly. And we now know that the infection fatality rate, rather than being 3.4% like that computer model, is probably something like 0.25%, you know, and that's because it's deadly for really old, elderly and sick people. So it's much less than that. So again, orders of magnitude less deadly than most people think. And so you have to say, okay, so where do we get our idea of how deadly it was? From the media. I mean, of course, nobody's studying the scientific literature, reading the World Health Organization's website. They're getting this from their news feeds and from the chyron at the bottom of the screen at CNN.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible, because if you just really drill down to the numbers, Ellen, in 2018, 228 million people suffered from malaria. But we don't hear about those numbers.
Not a peep.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and not a peep. You know?
I think
and
that hydroxychloroquine would have worked on that too, maybe.
And we gathered all the testimony from pastors, priests, and people that were lucky enough to use hydroxychloroquine early on. That is kind of amazing testimony. It requires a deep dive study, but the idea that we wouldn't try this when it's a fairly benign drug, really for entirely political reasons, it boggles the imagination.
It does. And why isn't Africa, China, Russia, and South America reporting these, you know, these tragic deaths? Why aren't they having the over-the-top responses? It looks like it is just a disease of the Western Hemisphere. Northern Hemisphere.
Okay, part of it is that they're not testing. And so guess what? You don't have a lot of cases if you don't have a lot of tests.
Right, not
testing. It's also a much younger population, which I think is the kind of key thing. Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, much younger than we are here. But East Asia, places like Taiwan and South Korea and Vietnam, in which very few people have died from this, I think that's evidence probably of some pre-existing immunity. I mean, you're right. We're going to spend the next several years reassessing and rethinking all the things that have happened. We wanted to, in the price of panic, just honestly try to persuade enough people to not do the lockdowns again in 2021. I mean, that was honestly our singular goal.
Oh, sad.
Jay Richards, he's joined us today. The name of the book is The Price of Panic, and it's available on Regnery Press. Jay Richards, William Briggs, and Douglas Axe have written that book. Pick it up. Jay, thanks for joining us. Hopefully we'll come back. We won't be talking about this into next year's podcast.
I hope so. Thank you.
Just for the record, I'm still mad.
Okay. Thanks for joining us, Jay. For Michelle McAloon, I'm Ellen Taylor, and you've been listening to Convergence. We'll talk to you next time.